searched in the corpus of contemporary American English, and I could find it in academic prose, for example, in medical writing, where people are talking about something being elevated off of the chest wall. The bottom line, is it okay to use based off of informal professional writing? There is some informal censure of based off of out there. And it's not just my colleague who wrote me. When I wrote a blog post about based off of for Lingua Franca for the Chronicle of Higher Education, the first commenter who wrote in response to my post wrote, "Off of makes me grind my teeth. Based off of makes me want to puke." That said, there isn't a lot of formal prescription on based off of, at least yet. In other words, the writers of style guides and usage manuals have not started paying attention to this new construction on the rise. It's not in Strunk and White's Elements of Style or Brian Garner's Modern American Usage. There is no usage note about based off of in the American Heritage Dictionary yet. In sum, change is afoot. And if usage guide writers continue to let it fly generally under the radar and don't clamp down on it as somehow wrong, then the change may happen fairly rapidly and based off of may become more and more standard in formal contexts. But right now, if you use based off of, you use it with some risk of judgment. I hope at this point in the course, this kind of guidance about usage is feeling satisfying. I'm not saying based off or based off of is wrong. I'm saying that it's on the rise and may be judged right now. This way, we can make educated decisions about what form we want to use. I would avoid based off or based off of informal writing right now. And I would alert students to the fact that others may not like that construction so that they can make informed choices. They may not want to irritate their readers if their readers are going to get irritated by based off of. But based off of is not something to judge anyone severely on or to lose your mind over. And I think it's worth watching to see if and when based off of speakers and writers become an ever larger percentage of writers, and perhaps at some point also of copy editors. Let's look at another tricky prepositional issue as we reflect on this approach to grammar and usage that shows careful attention to language choices without categorically calling things incorrect. Here are two sentences from a question on the American Heritage Dictionary usage ballot, and this will bring us full circle back to lecture one when I introduced the whole idea of the usage ballot. I'm going to give you these two sentences and you can see what you think. Sentence one. The teacher advocated a new educational technique. Are you okay with that sentence? I would guess that most, if not all of you are. I was. I voted completely acceptable. And the editors who made the ballot meant for that sentence to be completely standard. Here's sentence two. The teacher advocated for a new educational technique. Now what do you think? Did that one get you? Maybe you're grimacing right now over that sentence. I polled a class of 80 undergraduates on sentence two, and they overwhelmingly had no issue with it. The question is whether you can advocate for something that you want to happen or something you're trying to advance, or do you just advocate that. I went to the Corpus of Contemporary American English and went to the academic section, and I could find advocate for plus the noun of what people were advocating. For example, to advocate for continuation of funding, or to advocate for action on a bewildering array of diseases. So, when I voted on sentence two, on the usage ballot, I voted acceptable, and 45% of the panel was with me. Well, I guess I was in that 45%, so 44.5% of the panel was with me. So clearly, when you see that 45%, you can see that the panel is split on this right now, that some people don't mind it, some people still don't like advocate for. The American Heritage Dictionary editors, as a result of this split vote, stayed conservative in their summary. They wrote, and here I quote, "A careful writer will use advocate transitively without for." That they would only use the for in a sentence like, "She advocates for former foster children," where the foster children are the beneficiary, the people you're advocating for. As we've talked about, the panel is overall going to be fairly conservative, and that is helpful to know. It will keep you on the careful side of things if that's where you want to be. But notice that the American Heritage Dictionary editors do not say that advocate for plus the noun of the thing that you want to have happen is wrong. It's about choices, and choices that you are thinking through, that you're being careful about. And here I want to use careful in that sense of you're showing care, you're thinking them through, you're thinking about context and audience and expectations. And as part of our care, we should recognize that the opinions as voiced by usage guide writers and entities like the usage panel will change over time. Given all this, let's think again about what makes a grammar or usage rule a rule. As we've done throughout this course, we first distinguish the descriptive from the prescriptive. Descriptive rules are patterns that govern how we use the language to create grammatical utterances that others will understand. For example, the order in which determiners must occur, the insertion of do so that we ask, "Do you know," not "know you." The fact that we can and do strand prepositions because the language has that flexibility. Prescriptive rules, as we've talked about throughout the course, are created by real people at specific moments in time to try to manage the language, especially the written language. And they can do some very useful things. One of the things that prescriptive rules can do is distinguish standard forms and constructions from non-standard ones. This would be something like distinguishing ain't as non-standard. But please do remember, it doesn't mean that there's something inherently wrong with ain't. It's distinguishing standard usage, which can be a shared and useful form of communication, from non-standard. Some prescriptive rules aim to promote a particular kind of logic. This could be a rule such as none of the books is, rather than none of the books are. Some rules aim to maintain consistency, which can minimize distraction for readers. For example, the rules we talked about with commas, where if someone's always using the Oxford comma, that may minimize distraction for readers. Some of these prescriptive rules aim to minimize ambiguity in very useful ways. For example, think about those danglers. And if you don't have a dangling modifier, then you reduce the ambiguity for your reader. And because you can't be there to help your reader if they are confused, it's helpful to reduce the ambiguity. Some of these prescriptive rules aim to create aesthetically pleasing prose. For example, not splitting an infinitive with a whole lot of words between the to and the verb. Or for some people, not writing equally as, because that redundancy is not aesthetically pleasing. Some prescriptive rules try to preserve distinctions that historically have been there. For example, the difference between who and whom. And some prescriptive rules try to create distinctions where those distinctions may never have been quite so clear. Think about the distinction between less and fewer, as well as between that and which. Some prescriptive rules aim to advance equality in language and respect for other people's identities. Think here about singular they, both for generic uses and for individuals who identify outside the male-female binary. Categorizing rules this way is not meant, as I think you now know, to say that we shouldn't take these rules seriously, or that we shouldn't follow them if we think that they are on solid footing. It is to say that we can think critically about what those rules are trying to do and if we believe that that's a good idea. Now, I know, for example, that there's nothing wrong with impact as a verb, but I tend not to use it in formal writing right now because I don't want to distract or annoy people who care about impact as a verb. I also use singular they in a lot of my writing, but in a short university memo where I can't put in a little footnote, right now I'll probably just use he or she and not get into it. I'm making choices based on context and on audience. Did you catch what I did there? I said I'm making decisions based on context and audience. I could have said based off of context and audience, but I said based on, both because that's more part of my grammar and because I had a feeling that maybe some of you didn't like based off of. These are the kinds of informed decisions about grammar that I have in mind. I think it's empowering to think about grammar this way. It also reminds us that English usage is a living thing, changing along with the rollover of generations of speakers. When we think about grammar this way, it can make us more informed editors and better teachers, as well as savvier writers. What changes in the language should you be watching? As I've said before, predictions about language change are dangerous, but here goes. And I'm not alone here. I'm drawing on work by other scholars who've also ventured into the land of prediction. First, watch those new modals. In addition to hafta and gonna, we have some emerging modals like supposed to. Second, the demise of whom. As I've talked about, whom has been on the decline for hundreds of years, and it will probably continue to decline. Third, the growing acceptance of singular they. As we've talked about, we're now seeing this move into more and more formal genres, and I think that that will continue. Fourth, the expansion of the perfect and the progressive. This is something that linguists have been watching, and we're starting to see the perfect, where you might expect the past tense, and an increasing use of the progressive aspect. Fifth, the death of the subjunctive. Okay, it's really hard to know whether we're going to have or witness the death of the subjunctive. People have been predicting the death of the subjunctive for over 100 years, and it just won't die. I think one of the most remarkable things about the subjunctive is that it hasn't died yet. The subjunctive mood captures belief, intention, demands, desire, as well as states contrary to the facts. It appears in sentences such as, if I were grammar queen for a day, which is clearly hypothetical, or I insist that she wear the grammar crown. I insist that she wear, rather than she wears. That wear is the subjunctive. There we're seeing a demand. Or we could see the subjunctive in, I wish there were such a thing as a grammar queen and a grammar crown. I wish there were. This is my desire, but clearly it's not actually a reality. Many people don't know what the subjunctive is, aren't sure if English has a subjunctive. We still do have a subjunctive. And what's interesting is that some studies indicate that in American English, the use of the subjunctive is actually increasing in sentences like, I demand that he study grammar joyfully. Stay tuned. Watch that subjunctive. It isn't dead yet. Other things to watch. Watch for the increase in noun modifiers. For example, noun phrases like teaching company course lecture material. You'll notice there was no possessive in that string. Watch slash as a coordinator. Is it going to make it? And because as a preposition plus noun, because grammar. As I talked about, on accident seems to be coming into the language, and I think it might, in the long run, replace by accident. Much to my chagrin, impactful is making inroads into the language. I think I just have to give that one up. We've talked about quotative like. Quotative like might be here to stay as the way that many of us quote people in a story. He was like, she was like, that could be something that someone said or that they thought. And here's one more to watch for. Hone in will fully replace home in. Let me tell you a funny story on this last one. I used to correct hone in student writing, and I would change it to home in on. And I will admit that I felt a little bit smug when I did it. I thought, haha, I know that this technically should be home in, and I would underline it and I'd write home above hone and think, I'll bet the student didn't know that. Now, historically, I'm justified here, but I'm less justified in terms of current usage. Home in shows up in the 1920s, and it has since taken on the metaphorical meaning of to focus in, to focus on, to home in on something. That happened by the 1950s. By the 1960s, hone in on had taken on the same meaning. And you can imagine hone, meaning to sharpen, could come to take that meaning of focusing in on something. Is home in on losing its status as the standard form, or at least as the only standard form? This question was raised for me with this sentence that I read in a graduate student exam. Here's the sentence. Or a tutor might home in on an argument which runs counter to the tutor's own beliefs. I was reading the sentence and I thought, wow, home in on looks a little bit funny there. And the thing is that I knew that the only reason that she had written home in on there was because I had underlined it in an earlier draft and written home over hone, which is what she'd written in the first draft. I went to look at Google Books with the Ngram viewer, and what I discovered is that home in on is still more common, but the gap between home in on and hone in on has narrowed significantly. It raises the question for me of whether home in on will eventually be replaced and perhaps start to feel a little bit old-fashioned. And it was starting to look old-fashioned to me. It's why in that graduate student paper I noticed it, because I thought, ugh, that home in on is starting to look not quite right. The other possibility is that hone in on and home in on will continue to coexist as two standard forms being used synonymously. But I do wonder whether at some point writers will get criticized for using home in on instead of hone in on. In enforcing the rule, changing the hone in on to home in on, was I being helpful or was I being persnickety? Was it like changing nauseous into nauseated, where there is this idea that nauseous means causing nausea, as in the roller coaster was nauseous. But for most of us at this point, nauseous means nauseated, and I think it's being a little persnickety at this point to change nauseous into nauseated. I tell this story to show that I still fall prey to enforcing distinctions that may not be fully justified. But I try to keep an open mind so that I will change my practices as needed. I've also learned to be very careful about how and when I alert other people to a usage issue. This is an extremely powerful move, to stop someone when they're talking and to go Grammando on them. It can indicate to them that you're listening to how they're talking as much or more than to what they're saying. It's one thing if you're a teacher and you're reading a piece of formal writing and you're underlining things and writing a more standard usage above it. It's another thing if you're in a conversation anywhere. It can be a silencing move to stop someone and correct them. And we see this online when people are chatting or arguing online. And one of the most powerful moves you can make when you get really angry is to correct somebody else's grammar and to say, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't even know how to use an apostrophe. I remember a time in graduate school when I was talking to a friend of mine who used what linguists call a positive anymore. He said, "They sell shoes there anymore." And I said, "You're a positive anymore speaker." At which point he looked like a deer caught in the headlights and looked like he wanted to stop talking, which is exactly what he did. And I was, in fact, excited about what he just said, but he was struck by the fact that I'd called him out on the way he was using the language, not what he was saying. I also remember a story from my own schooling where I was in an English seminar and I was saying the word rhetoric as rhetoric because I knew the word rhetorical and clearly hadn't heard rhetoric said out loud all that often. After class, the professor, as we were on the way out the door, just said to me, "You know, Anne, a lot of people say that rhetoric." It was the kindest correction in private, not in front of other people. What I hope we can do is embrace how much we care about language and use that caring for good. We can create beautiful prose or clever prose or efficient prose or funny prose in a variety of genres, both formal and informal, being careful about how we use the language, being deliberate in our grammatical choices without being unnecessarily or overly fussy. Of course we're going to notice things in the language. That is my life. We'll notice typos, and then we can decide what we want to make of them. Was this just a quick email? Is this a sloppy proofreader? Is this someone who didn't really care about the document, and do we want to draw conclusions from that? Is this someone who's focusing their intellectual energies on other things and not on apostrophes? We'll also notice new grammatical developments in the language and differences across regions and social groups. Of course we'll notice these. We can't control that. What we can control is what we think we know about that person based on that bit of grammar, or based on their accent, or a word choice that reflects what region they're from, or what social group they identify with. And we can control what judgments we want to make based on that knowledge that we have. We can control any impulse we might have to go grammando when we hear something. Does that thought we had, that grammando-like thought, stay in our head, or do we say it out loud? What is our goal? What is the context? Are we being helpful or hurtful? Are we sure we're right? Let's think of ourselves as caretakers of the language, tending it to allow it to work in all its powerful, effective ways. To be effective, language, both written and spoken, must respond to its audience and context, which requires some flexibility in what kind of grammar is preferred. And as we've talked about, there are many English grammars. The formal written standard is just one of them. To be effective, formal written language benefits from consistency so as not to distract readers and from minimizing ambiguity. You're not there to clarify. And to be effective, language needs to be creative, to be allowed to surprise us and to adapt to the needs and desires of the speakers and writers who are both older and younger than we are. Next time you find yourself contemplating a grammatical construction that strikes your ear as not quite right, if not downright wrong, imagine yourself being asked to judge its acceptability as if you were a member of the usage panel. I hope this course has given you new tools and perspectives to approach that question, to think about what acceptability means, in what context, and how that may change over time. You've gained some key tools, for example, usage guides and an informed perspective on how you want to use those as a writer and a speaker. You now can turn to Google Books and the Ngram Viewer and the Corpus of Contemporary American English and the Corpus of Historical American English to answer your questions about what's going on with grammar in different registers of the language. With this knowledge and these tools, you can effectively be an advocate for, notice how I sidestep the whole advocate for as a verb issue, you can be an advocate for what you see as the most effective language choices, be those more conservative or more playful, be those choices that stay within the boundaries of traditionally accepted usage, or choices that exuberantly push the boundaries of accepted usage. I hope you will remember that whatever you choose, be that to embrace tradition or to embrace change, you're following in the footsteps of many eloquent speakers and writers who precede us. In the end, to make those kinds of decisions about grammar more consciously and deliberately, with your descriptive and prescriptive grammatical ducks metaphorically lined up behind you, that is what it means to harness the power of language. Thank you for spending these hours geeking out about grammar with me, sharing our peeves and our passions. May you split an infinitive when you need to, and strand a preposition when it sounds right. May you follow your gut and your heart about whether it should be equally as important or equally important. And may English grammar be one of your life's pleasures.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are available online or via the free Great Courses app for smartphones and tablets, available on the App Store or Google Play. View our full library at thegreatcourses.com. Or as always, you can call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.